Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Bacon Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Theo Pauline Nestor about her new memoir. Right now, I'd like to welcome Dmitry Tomosko. He's a professor of music at Princeton University, and he will be giving a lecture titled The Geometry of Consonants, Music and Mathematics on Wednesday, the 13th of August at 7:30 at the James A. Little Theater at the New Mexico School for the Deaf here in Santa Fe. Welcome, Dmitry, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
Now, in your work, to the very limited extent that I have been able to grasp it so far, you've made maps of musical chords using multidimensional geometry that help to make connections among the many varieties of Western music. First of all, what led you to this mapping project in the first place?
Well, I sort of wear two hats. On the one hand, I'm a composer, so I'm trying to put notes together in a way that sound good. And on the other hand, I'm a music theorist, so I'm trying to think abstractly about what is it that makes music sound good. And basically, I do this second job for purely selfish reasons. I figure if I have some understanding of what makes music sound good, my own search process when I'm trying to write music will be shortened, right? Because if you have a conceptual understanding about what makes music sound good, it's not just a random process of hunting and pecking and sort of searching for which piano key is going to sound exactly perfect next.
Now, that's a very tall order, what makes music sound good, especially if there's like a mathematical or somehow abstract reality to what makes music sound good, that it's not entirely subjective. How do you understand that?
Right. Well, this is a very interesting issue. First of all, there is a long-standing connection between music and mathematics. So we've known that there are various aspects of musical structure that are mathematical for thousands of years. In fact, you can make the case that the very first discovery of mathematical physics, made by Pythagoras almost 3,000 years ago, was in fact a discovery about music, and that he noticed that that vibrating bodies sounded particularly consonant or sounded nice together when their lengths were related by simple whole number ratios. So that's just one of many instances of the sort of deep connection between mathematical facts and musical facts. Of course, not all aspects of music are mathematical, and there's a lot of intuition and expression and emotion that goes into the process of music making. But I think that people often underestimate the amount of calculation that's involved, too. Even the most spontaneous-seeming jazz musician practices an awful lot and makes use of sort of quasi-mathematical patterns. Now, the second issue you raised was one about subjectivity. And I would say that you suggested a view that's a very common one, which is that what makes music sound good is a completely subjective issue. And, you know, one person likes strawberry ice cream and one person likes vanilla ice cream. And in much the same way, some people like Bach and other people like rock music and still other people like very dissonant atonal music. I would say that in the first part of the 20th century, the received wisdom among composers was a subjectivist one, where the idea was that the human musical mind was extremely malleable and that we could learn to appreciate a wide range of musics, and that the music of the Western tradition was really only a small corner of the musical universe. I would say that as we begin the 21st century, people's thinking on this issue has changed significantly, and we now understand that it may well be the case that there are fairly significant constraints on what makes music sound good, and that there are some interesting biological and cognitive features of our mind that make us that make most people intuitively attracted to music of a certain sort rather than another.
I'd like to come back to that in a few minutes because it's important and very profound. But first, let's look at some of the specifics that you are delving into in your mapping work. You have found that Bach, let's say, you know, Bach, Stravinsky, and Coltrane have deep similarities. What are these similarities that on the surface of it we might not hear so easily? And can you, I know you're sitting near a piano, I was wondering if you could demonstrate any of that.
Well, sure. I think that one way of thinking about this is that the really deep similarities are, they're not very esoteric. They're the kinds of things that you teach an elementary music student. So it's not so much, what's surprising is not so much that there exist these similarities, but that we can represent them in a very elegant mathematical way. So one similarity is that melodies tend to move by short distances. So if you imagine singing a song, you're going to be singing something that sounds like this, where you're moving by relatively short distances on a piano keyboard. You're not going to sing something that sounds like this, right, and taking very wide jumps along the piano keyboard. Mm-hmm. So that principle is the principle that melodies should move by short distances. Another very, very basic principle of the sort that you might explain to an 11-year-old music student is that when you combine multiple notes at the same time, they should combine to form coherent harmonies. Now, in my work, I take a very general attitude toward coherent harmony. I say, look, you can choose any chord you want, but a basic principle of music is that the chords you choose should sound similar to one another. So if you choose a major chord like this, if you're going to create a musical piece, you might want to combine a bunch of chords that sound similar like this. So there I played a series of chords. And if you stopped the music at any one time, you would hear a chord that was audibly similar to the chords that you heard at other times. So that's a kind of chord progression you might find in Bach. In jazz, you might hear something more like this. So richer chords, but they also have a certain structural integrity and consistency. And then in very dissonant modern music, of course, you hear chords like this. And again, typically these chords have a kind of sonic affinity to one another. What you don't tend to find is music that jumps willy-nilly among all these different chords. So you wouldn't really hear something that went... You know, that's a little bit more chaotic sounding.
Right.
So these two principles, they're not themselves surprising, and I don't think that they would cause any music teacher anywhere to bat an eye. What's rather remarkable is that those two principles in and of themselves set very strict constraints on the kinds of music that we can construct. And you can understand those constraints if you realize that there are natural geometrical models of musical structure.
And those are models that you can and actually have mapped.
Sure. And there's actually a bunch of different ways to do it. I think when people hear about my work, they naturally are attracted to the sort of high-tech aspect of it. So they get kind of interested in the fact that there are these higher dimensional models, and you can represent musical chords, use two-note chords using a Mobius strip, and so on and so forth. But there's actually even simpler models that allow you to understand an awful lot of musical structure. In some sense, you can think of a piano keyboard as a very basic geometrical model. A piano keyboard is essentially a line, you know, and down at one end of the line you have the low notes. And up at the other end of the line, you have the high notes. And so you can use, say, a simple one-dimensional line to represent very clearly what a pianist is doing with his or her fingers. If you want to understand the semantic content, the meaning of music, the piano keyboard is not a very good representation, and you can say the same for standard musical notation. So the next class of geometrical models, the next most informative way of representing music is by thinking of it on a circle. And here we invoke what I call Maria's theorem, after Maria and the Sound of Music, who teaches us that as we move along the piano keyboard, do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, we eventually come to a place that seems exactly like, or seems very similar to the place that we started. And this is called octave equivalence among music theorists. And the idea is basically that piano keys that are 12 keys away from one another sound awfully similar to one another. And so to capture this profound psychological notion of musical equivalence, you can almost imagine taking the piano keyboard, which is a line, and rolling it up into a circle. And so in my talk, one of the things I will do is show how you can represent a number of sort of famous musical passages as motions along the circle. And when you think about music in this circular sense, you can start to understand some of the deeper constraints that I referred to earlier that limit the kinds of music musical coherence that we can achieve in our music.
We're talking to Dmitry Timosko, who is going to be speaking at the James A. Little Theater on Wednesday, the 13th of August. It's a Santa Fe Institute-sponsored event. You know, you've pointed out that students of Western music are taught mostly a narrow range of music, namely the classical tradition from 1700 to 1900. What's that all about? Why is that?
Oh, this is a very good question. I think that's essentially because this is the only kind of music we really know how to talk about well. There's a remarkable fact, which is most college students, when they go off to study music, are essentially taught the music of the increasingly distant past. So if you were to go to study music at Harvard or at Berkeley, to choose just institutions I'm familiar with, jazz would not be at all part of the curriculum. And rock music and other popular forms are sort of looked down upon. And you can actually trace the beginnings of this attitude toward music education to the fact that there was a lot of confusion in the mid-20th century about sort of what music was and where music was going. And some very influential people said, rather than try to sort of synthesize and make sense out of all the different things that are happening in 20th century music, we're going to stick to the music of the past, which we understand and which is sort of a fixed body of music that's not changing on us. And essentially what happened is music departments turned themselves from being French departments into Latin departments. They went from being places where they were teaching a living, breathing language into curators of a past musical language.
That's so true.
I actually think part of the problem here is really a conceptual problem, which is that we don't have a good way of organizing all of these different musical styles that are now part of our culture, and of thinking about what is shared between Bach and the Beatles, say. And that's one of the things that I'm trying to rectify. Both when I teach music, I try to teach a really broad panoply of different styles, and in my scholarship, I'm trying to sort of give people a way of understanding at a very basic level some of these similarities that link different musical languages.
And it's interesting because it's both a sort of how do I say this? It's a kind of democratic principle that's linking all of these different styles of music that are separated by place and even class. But also, I mean, you're looking at universal principles. And I was thinking, because the word map comes up in your work. You know, you made the analogy to mapping a city and seeing that there are all sorts of intersections. But in a way, a city is arbitrary in a way that the mappings that you are doing are not. You're mapping things that are more like Platonic spheres and you know, solids than like arbitrary man-made places like cities.
Well, that's a good point. Another analogy I sometimes use is that when you look at the history of music, when you look at the history of music, it's a little bit like watching a mountain climber climb up a jagged rock face. And the mountain climber takes various turns and has various choices about which way he or she can go at any one point. But these choices, even though the mountain climber has a certain degree of free will, these choices are constrained by the underlying shape of the mountain, right? You're not going to do something stupid like reject an obvious handhold that's in front of you. So one of the wonderful things about music history is because of these intrinsic constraints that are sort of built into the very logic of musical coherence, you can do something that's a little bit more robust than what you find in other branches of history, which is you can sort of start to understand why things progressed in certain ways, or why certain kinds of developments occurred, or why certain composers chose to do one thing rather than another. So you get a little bit more of a sort of principled and unified account of why things happened the way they did, and this is largely a function of the fact that we're all working with the same 12 notes and the same basic piano keyboard, and you know, there are only so many ways to satisfy really elemental musical constraints.
So how has the project that you've been doing and the geometrical understanding that you've found affect the way that you compose music?
This is a good question. I guess in one sense, it has sort of helped me justify the way I approach music, because I grew up, you know, I was born at the very, very tail end of the 1960s, and for me, I never felt that there were vast differences between musical styles. So, you know, my parents introduced me to the Beatles and to Bach at more or less the same time, and they were both musics of the past that my parents taught me to love and that I naturally had an inclination to love. When I went to college and started studying music professionally, I found a lot of pressure from academic composers and composers who are interested in atonal music. I felt a lot of pressure to sort of write dissonant music that had nothing to do with this kind of music that I loved. And I certainly found I was strongly discouraged from, say, trying to combine elements of popular music with elements of classical music. So one of the things that my theoretical work has helped me do is to really understand that the idea of synthesizing these different styles, or the idea of being interested in tonal music or music that sounds good, is pretty reasonable, and that, you know, it's given me, say, an intellectual response to those people who feel that what I'm doing is, say, too eclectic or too pluralistic or too tonal or too old-fashioned.
We're talking to Dmitri Tomosko. The relationship between music and, you know, human emotional spiritual experience is, I think, pretty much cross-culturally universal. And at the same time, the relationship between music and the laws of physics and mathematics are also apparent. And there is this, you know, it's as if there's this kind of pre-existing music that pre-exists us in the way that hydrogen atoms pre-existed our perception of hydrogen atoms, you know, in the universe,
right.
pre-existed human evolution. And so there's this, you know, very interesting territory that, I mean, human beings have been going into for a long time, and you're furthering this work, but there's some sense of, like, you know, plumbing the mysteries of the, you know, probing the mysteries of the universe here, and the relationship between, you know, human perception and these sort of immutable laws.
Yeah, this is sort of a complicated issue. I suspect that evolution is a big part of the story here. There are a lot of people who are starting to think that music might be a specifically human adaptation. So there are a fair number of reasonably universal features of human musical experience that are not found in other animals. One of them is octave equivalence, so the idea that we hear a C down here as being related to a C up here. That's pretty much a human universal, and it's surprisingly absent in other mammals, so far as we know. This is not a settled scientific issue.
And other mammals do have their music, like birds and whales and so on.
Yeah, well, again, there's of course a big scientific discussion
right.
about whether we should call that music or
right.
not, but let's agree to do it here. I don't have a big stake in that issue. Another really interesting universal, or seemingly universal, is that humans seem to be attracted to consonants. So we hear this sound as particularly restful and stable, and we hear this as much more dissonant, you know, or something like this. And those sorts of sounds tend to make us much more uneasy. And again, among animals, you find sensitivity to the difference between consonants and dissonants, but you don't find the same strong preference for consonant sounds over dissonant sounds. Again, this is very much an unsettled region of science, but that's what things seem to look like right now. You put enough facts like this together, and you start to wonder whether music making might have been something that was very important to primitive human beings, and something that sort of brought us together into communities and into societies, and, you know, whether communal singing and dancing was so important as to actually affect in various ways the shape of our brain. And actually, one sort of remarkable aside here is that music is the site of one of the few honest-to-God superpowers. So most people do not have absolute pitch, and if you play them this note and then tell them to go run around the building and come back 10 minutes later and then play them this note, they won't be able to tell the difference between those two notes. There's a select group of human beings who can, of course, tell the difference, and these people have the gift of absolute or perfect pitch. And that seems to be an actual biological mutation. And so it really is like a kind of magical superpower, like X-ray vision or something like that, except it's not in the realm of fiction. It's a real phenomenon. And so if you reflect that there is an actual biological mutation that seems to confer unusual musical ability on some human beings, that gives you a sense of just how important music might have been in human experience.
And you're still left with, you know, what you were talking about at the beginning, these whole number ratios having a certain effect on human beings. You know, I mean, octaves don't have those effects on other animals, but there is this physical, you know, the string is twice as long as the other string and the notes are at octaves and they sound the same. That, I mean, is that a human creation, or is that a sort of pre-existing thing? And I don't even know if that's a good question.
I think that it's the way I would answer the question is it is a universal creation. It's a universally perceived creation of human evolution. So it is universal among humans, but it might not be. We could imagine meeting an alien species who didn't have that perception. So they wouldn't think that T brought us back to Do, and they might not hear this note. They might not hear this note as being particularly identical to the note an octave below it. So
the fact that this physical relationship of you know, the whole numbers, the thing being twice as long, exists may not be particularly meaningful.
Well, it's meaningful to us.
Right.
I would say that a human universal built into the structure of our brains that exploits genuinely physical, real physical properties, I would say that's pretty meaningful. I think that it is possible that sort of other species or intelligent aliens might have very different musics that we couldn't really imagine, but I don't think that's any reason to sort of get discouraged about the meaningfulness of our own music. If you go back to the early 20th century, there were a lot of musicians and composers who rejected this idea of musical universals or who tried to construct music out of very gnarly and dissonant sounds, you know, chords like this sort of thing, or I'm not even very good at playing dissonant sounds randomly because my fingers tend to make consonant sounds automatically. But they sort of thought you could construct an entire musical language that was insensitive to or rejected these sort of fundamental human musical universals. And in many ways, that project failed, and that music never caught on with anything like the way its creators hoped it had. And when you look back on that, you can see these people. They're analogous to, say, linguists who tried to construct artificial languages while violating all of the things that linguists have discovered about human universals in language.
Dmitry Timosko is a professor of music at Princeton University, and once again, he's giving a lecture sponsored by the Santa Fe Institute called The Geometry of Consonants, Music and Mathematics on Wednesday, the 13th of August at 7:30 at the James A. Little Theater, which is at the New Mexico School for the Deaf here in Santa Fe. Dmitry, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
My pleasure.
We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be right back. Please stay tuned. I'd like now to welcome Theo Pauline Nestor. She is the author of a new memoir called How to Sleep Alone in a King-Size Bed, and she will be speaking and signing books this evening at 7 o'clock at Borders Bookstore on Montezuma. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
So this is a book that spans the time in your life between separation and divorce. It's a very vulnerable time in a person's life, in a woman's life, especially mm-hmm. if you're the mother of children. Why did you decide to make it public, to write the memoir?
You know, I almost felt like I didn't have a choice, which is something that people say sometimes when they do have a choice. I had written another book about motherhood, and I thought I might be continuing to write on the topic of motherhood, and then suddenly my husband and I split up, and I couldn't write about anything else. And I just found this material just needed to be written. I just had this incredible need to write about it. And then out of a weird series of events, I was very easily able to sell the book proposal. And so here I was. I was writing about my divorce. It was just one of those chain of events where I felt like it was meant to be. I was supposed to write this book.
It's interesting. The seed of the book was an article called "The Chicken's in the Oven, My Husband's Out the Door." The time it took you to make the decision to end your marriage was less than the time that it took to cook a chicken.
I know some people might say it's about, you know, poor impulse control. You know, in a way, I had made the decision years before because my husband had a problem with gambling. And years before, about 6 years before the chicken day, I had decided that I really was going to give our marriage another go, and if we could make it, that would be great. But if he lapsed back into the gambling and broke trust again, then I wouldn't be able to do it. So the day of the chicken, as it's now called, I found out that he had been gambling again, and this was after, as far as I knew, 6 years without, and it was just sort of inconceivable that the last 6 years that I had been trusting this person, that trust had actually, you know, eroded. So, yes, I mean, in a way I did make it before the chicken came out, but it was a long time in the coming.
So, the resulting shock, and I think this is true for everybody, is multidimensional. It's, you know, personal, financial, identity, the rhythm of your life. All of these things are suddenly really changed. What was the most immediate for you?
I have to say identity. I think that I'm a person, and this comes through a lot in the memoir, is that I'm a person, and I was more so a few years ago, who's, I guess, really concerned with what other people think. And no one wants to brag about that. We're all supposed to be, you know, sort of brave and not really care what other people think. But I live in a sort of a tight-knit community, and most of the people I knew were married and had children. And all of a sudden, I had this strange identity switch where I didn't belong to the club anymore. And that shock took me a long time to get over, because I didn't know quite how I fit into my community now that I was a single mother.
You talked about somewhere the getting out of the spell of married middle-class thinking. How do you characterize married middle-class thinking?
You know, for me, what it was this belief that things are going to be all right. Like, and I really feel as if it is easier for me to believe that married. No matter, I guess, you know, it was obvious that I did have some problems in my marriage, but I sort of believed that together we would figure it out. And, you know, financially, emotionally, and raising the kids, somehow it was all going to be all right. And I really felt like only half of the responsibility for that outcome was mine, you know. So it was like, yes, it was sort of up to me, but it was not really completely up to me. And that sort of break of married middle-class magical thinking, as I called it, came with the split, because all of a sudden I realized, oh my gosh, it's all up to me. And I guess a lot of that had to do with raising my kids by myself and supporting them.
We're talking to Theo Pauline Nestor. I mean, one of the things that you point out, and I think this is really much more true when there are children involved, is that just because you are divorced doesn't mean the relationship is over.
Right. Yeah. No. The relationship isn't over. And that was a bit of a shock for me, because one of the elements of this book is not only am I divorced, but like a lot of people who are divorced, I'm a child of divorce. My parents divorced back in 1962, which is actually one of the lowest points in the century for the divorce rate. The other time it was this low was 1942, which is because everybody was involved in World War II. They really couldn't get a divorce, even if they wanted to. So when my parents...
They weren't there to fight with each other either.
Like, who can you fight with? So when my parents split up, in my early childhood, I was sort of like, you know, one of the only divorced kids. And my parents, they didn't really have a model for how do you do divorce when there's children. And what they chose to do was basically divide the continent. My mother got California, and my father moved to Mexico he bought a cattle ranch near Guadalajara. And that, he took my sister with him, my sister Kathy, that I write about in the book, and they were off in Mexico. My mom and I were in California, and there was no co-parenting whatsoever. So I, you know, when I became divorced, I suddenly had to, sort of like marriage, I had to do something that I had never seen a model for, because I hadn't seen my parents married. When I was married, I was kind of winging it. But also in divorce, I was winging it too. Because,
well, you did the opposite. Instead of a continent away, you were a block away from one another.
Yeah, at first we were a block away. Holy cow, that was exciting. And sharing a dog. We were walking our dog back and forth too. we have decided to stay very involved in each other's life because we want to raise the kids pretty much together. Neither of us is willing to give up our time with the kids. So we see each other at least a couple of times a week, and we have to have a lot of conversations about who's going to pay the copay on this dental bill and, you know, what about braces and, you know, just all the daily chores of raising children we do together.
There is this, I think, very difficult thing that probably all parents in all eras have faced, which is, on the one hand, wanting to protect your children, and then on the other hand, wanting them to know the truth about what's going on around them. Mm-hmm. How do you negotiate that?
I think that is, it's like a constant struggle, and I think it's probably a struggle for parents, who, whether they're divorced or not. I mean, I think we all have elements of our life that are, you know, PG-13 and above, that, you know, it's like really, it's hard to know when is the time to share this information with your child, like a family member's drug use or something else. And, you know, I think that with a divorce, it's particularly hard because you're talking about their other parent. And, you know, I was very nervous to say in the beginning, well, this is happening because of your father, because your father has a gambling problem. But my older daughter, who was 9 at the time, for her, she really questioned, why are my parents divorcing? Because there was no clue of it in her mind before that. And so my ex-husband and I decided, luckily, he decided that he wanted to be open about the cause of the divorce, because that took some of the onus of the task off me to decide to tell her. So he was open with both our kids about it. And that has helped a lot, because it's not something we go into at great depth, but they understand he has a problem, and that was what caused the decline of the marriage.
It's funny. Some years ago, I was talking with a friend about how we were in similar parts of our lives and or stages of our lives, and about, you know, when there's a major breakup or separation or divorce or whatever, somebody really should write a book about the stages of what happens, just the way, like Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, you know,
right.
Denial and acceptance and, you know, spend time with people you wouldn't bring home to your mother, you know,
right,
get
right.
over that, et cetera,
right.
et cetera. And you've kind of done that. It's separated into denial, adjustment, and acceptance in your memoir.
Well, I found it, you know, when I was going through it, partly because I didn't have any friends who were divorced, I wanted some sort of guideline. Like, I'm going, okay, I don't feel like going out of the house. Well, I always feel that way, but that stage turned out to be about 3 or 4 months. And then shortly after that, I had a little bit of a wild stage, which is, I've read since then in books about divorce, completely normal. You sort of have a adolescence. Sometimes people have a kind of like their little midlife crisis. I really didn't have a book that said, okay, this is what you're going to feel. And I mean, it's
well,
obvious.
How could there be? Does everybody
right.
feel the same thing?
No. And I mean, obviously, there's going to be a lot of variance between people and their experience. But at the same time, there are certain experiences that you can pretty much count on. Like the beginning, you're not going to feel like eating. You know, you're just absolutely in crisis. There's a good chance, like, you're not going to be able to sleep at all. Like, a lot of people have that problem, and it can go on for months. A lot of people really have a period where they want to isolate themselves. Then there's this period where a lot of people have sort of a personal renaissance. And that's one of the only fun parts, I guess, about a divorce, is this period where, you know, all of a sudden you're taking up rollerblading or drumming or, you know, African dance or something. And you want to express yourself, this part of yourself maybe that was dormant during the marriage.
Well, it seems like it's a very big thing for a lot of people, and I don't know if it would be ruining it to read the last paragraph of the book, but I was really I was really struck. Would you like
sure.
to read that? I was really struck by that.
Thank you.
Is that it?
Yeah, the divorce has
Right.
So this is the last, you know, it's not a cliffhanger book.
Right.
So, you know.
We're not giving away the ending.
I have to say the plot of the book is pretty simple. You know, a middle class woman gets a divorce and, you know.
And survives.
Looks for a job, gets a new boyfriend. Not a lot. It's a very internal book, and it's kind of, you know, just about all the things that I went through in this first year, especially after the divorce. So this is the last paragraph. Divorce has returned to me the rawness of spirit I had as a girl. The girl who was disconsolate when her canary died, who snuck out the window to see her boyfriend, who slammed the fridge door, opened it, and slammed it one more time when she didn't get what she wanted. She was the girl who stayed awake to watch the shooting stars on a velvety August night, sprained her ankle jumping for joy in the school library, and memorized all the lyrics of Joni Mitchell's Court and Spark. The girl who begged friends to bowl just one more game.
You know, when I read that, I thought, if marriage drums that out of you, mm-hmm. there's a problem here.
You know, I haven't yet had the marriage that doesn't. I've only been married one time, and my hope is that a good marriage doesn't. That you, there is, I believe in good marriage. That's one thing that I'm not an embittered divorcee who never plans to marry again. Like, I actually, I'm quite a romantic. And I believe that there's such a thing as a union between two people that absolutely brings out the best in each other. And part of it is brings out that true self in each other so that both people do feel free to explore who they want to be. And so my marriage didn't do that for me. And whether that's, you know, my doing or my husband's doing or a bad match between two people, I'm not quite sure where the root of it is. But I see people that have marriages where they say, yeah, you go, you be that person. And I believe in that.
We're talking to Theo Pauline Nestor about her memoir, How to Sleep Alone in a King-Size Bed. What do you think? I mean, am I right in assuming that this book is written more for a female audience?
Absolutely. I mean, if men want to read it, and a few men have, and they've said, I liked it and I'm a man, that's awesome. I mean, I know that some men going through divorce probably will pick it up, and I hope that they relate to the story. But I think it's a woman's book, and I also think it's a book not just for women going through divorce, but for women who are starting over at midlife, you know, midlife start-overs, which people have for a number of reasons. Sometimes it's because of an empty nest. Sometimes it's because of a, you know, sudden career change or they're widowed. But, you know, I've had married and all sorts of women say, hey, I related to it even though I wasn't divorced.
What do you think that, maybe I should ask this as a personal question, what did you need and what do you think people most need when they are women, when they're suddenly alone from their friends?
Mm-hmm. You need sort of a variety of things. Like, one is you need at least one friend who's kind of maternal, who's just going to listen to you and who will let you cry and who will let you sort of rant and rave when you're angry or frustrated or really scared. And just kind of that primal need to be nurtured and taken care of. That was one need that I had from my friends that was absolutely met. And then another is you do need a certain kind of like problem-solving friends, like people who can go, okay, you can call an attorney for that, or okay, so this is what people do when they're looking for work again. You know, just kind of help you, talk to you about, like, because a lot of times when a person is going through a divorce, they're making multiple life decisions at once. A lot of times for women, it's a return to work. For a lot of times, for men more than women, but also for women, it's a change of housing. Like, all of a sudden, you're moving on top of everything else. Plus, you're dealing with a legal system, and for a lot of people, it's for the very first time in their life. So you kind of need more than people who will listen. Like, I needed people who would say, okay, there's resources. Like, try this, try that, try this.
Here's a phone number. It's
yeah,
on this block.
Yeah, because, like, sometimes, like, when you're depressed, you can't even think of these things or the resources. And then I think you need friends to have a good time with, too. Like, you just need to get out of the house and, like, go have fun again.
It seems like, I mean, one of the things that you talked about a lot is denial and the things that you had to face. And it seems like denial is built into most people's lives, because in order to have a harmonious companionship with someone, even your friends, you know, there's certain subjects you stay away from. And when that person is your life companion, you stay away from those subjects all the time. And then they sort of cease to exist on some level.
Right.
And then suddenly they're in your face.
Yeah. I mean, in a way, I think, like, a lot of the book is about my recovery from denial. I think because of just being a child of divorce and some other, like, addiction issues in my family, it's really second nature for me to just see, like, the good in something once I've picked it. Like, you know, I might see flaws in something before I've picked it, but once I'm on the boat with it, it's like, oh, it's all good, it's all working out. And I guess it's just really scary for most people, and for, I know for myself, to be able to be in something like a marriage or a friendship or a job and sort of actively hold the consciousness like there are problems that we need to work on. And so as the book opens and I'm coming out of my denial about my ex-husband's gambling, I start to realize this sort of mindset that I had that allowed me not to see it. And a lot of it is, in a way, kind of an addiction to busyness that's really easy to have if you have two young children. But I think that a lot of times I have kept myself so busy that I won't be able to see things that are around me, especially if I don't know what to do about them.
Theo Pauline Nestor is the author of the memoir, How to Sleep Alone in a King-Size Bed, and she will be speaking and signing books this evening at 7 o'clock at Borders Bookstore on Montezuma Street in the San Busco Center. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
By the way, we announced yesterday when we talked about the film The Dahmer Brothers that it was opening at the CCA, the Center for Contemporary Arts, this Friday. In fact, it's next Friday, the 15th of August, so check that out. You can also go to ccasantafe.org and see what else is happening there. Tomorrow, we will be speaking with Martha Burke about her book, Your Money and Your Life, The High Stakes for Women Voters in 08, and the new radio series that she is doing. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're podcasting at the website santaferadiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz with John Greenspan features Artist of the Month Al Cohn. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. Hasta mañana. Thank you.